10:15 in the morning, we're going to call the Agriculture Policy Committee meeting to order. We have a busy day today, some testifiers that have come a long ways to be with us today, so we want to give them the time that they need to get through their presentations. Kind of a special guest, first of all, today is the day we're going to hear about the Tractor Safety Rollover Protection Bill. Have a couple of bills that address that. And really, a special guest, Julie Sorensen, is with us this morning. Julie is from New York State, and I had a chance to hear her at the Department of Agriculture down the hill here a couple of months back, and her presentation is excellent. And New York State kind of led the way with the program of a rollover protection for older tractors, and Wisconsin has a program, and I thought we could be able to do that here too in Minnesota. So we've talked to Julie, and she graciously has agreed to come and speak with us this morning and to tell us about the New York program. So give it a listen and see what you think. But Minnesota, welcome, Julie. And a storm coming tonight, so be careful. Okay.
I know. We'll see if I end up leaving Minnesota tonight. Might be a little dicey. But can everybody hear me okay?
Yeah. Okay. And identify yourself for the record, please.
Okay. My name is Dr. Julie Sorensen, and I am the director for the Northeast Center for Occupational Health and Safety in Cooperstown, New York.
Okay. Go ahead with your presentation.
Okay. So I will be trying to move through this a little quickly because I know there's very little time. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the ROPS program that we've developed in New York and recent efforts to disseminate ROPS programs throughout the U.S. So let's get started. I think numbers are often very compelling. So here's our first number, 1,411. This is the number of farmers who have died in tractor overturns between 1992 and 2005. Tractor overturns are the most frequent cause of death on farms in the United States. 99%. This is the effectiveness of roller protective structures, or they're also known as roll bars, when worn with a seatbelt. So they protect the tractor operator in the event of an overturn. 40%, another number. This is the percentage of U.S. tractors that do not have ROPS. 80%. When we did a little initial research into the issue of ROPS protection in New York State, we found that 80% of New York farmers had not considered installing ROPS on their tractors that didn't have ROPS. So we started this project in 2005. So obviously, this is an interesting public health challenge because it's the most frequent cause of death. We have a known solution that's commercially available. Why aren't farmers using them or installing them? So in 2005, I went around interviewing farmers, farm wives, farm partners, business partners, and conducting focus groups. And what I found out was there were three primary barriers that farmers experienced in the decision to install a ROPS on a tractor that didn't have one. The first one was cost. They said the roll bars are considerably expensive. They can be $1,000 on average to purchase and install. And if you think about the value of the tractor, it's a lot of money comparatively. A lot of smaller farms are operating with marginal or small profit margins, and they need to invest money in equipment that will actually have return on investment. And then the other thing they mentioned is it takes a lot of time to find the right parts. You have to call, you know, several dealers. You have to do price comparisons. And they said this is just time we don't have. And I think given the challenges, farmers have, develop the coping mechanism of just reassuring themselves that it's not going to happen to them because, there's no ready or easy way to deal with it. So in response, we decided to set up a ROPS rebate program in New York State. We launched it in 2007. You probably can't see this graphic, so I'll just talk you through how the process works. It starts, a farmer wants to install a ROPS on his tractor, so he calls our hotline number. We ask a few questions about the tractor that he wants to retrofit, what kind of roll bar or ROPS system he would prefer or she would prefer. They might want a folding ROPS. There might be specifics that they're interested in. So what we do on our hotline is we look at the different options available. We price out different models from different dealerships. And we send that information to the farmer, and we let them know how much the ROPS would cost, what their out-of-pocket cost would be. And then it's up to them. You know, they can either follow through and purchase the roll bar or not. And if they want to purchase the roll bar, then they just call us, and we make sure that there's still money in the rebate fund available. And then we give them the go-ahead, and they install the ROPS. And, you know, we ask them to provide proof of installation, which involves receipts for the parts and a before and after picture of the roll bar on the tractor. The other thing that I thought it was important to mention was we have disseminated this program to other states in the Northeast, and other states have really just said, we just want to pay for ROPS rebates. We just want to give money for ROPS rebates. The issue with that is farmers can't take advantage of a program they know nothing about. So in New York State, about 20% of our ROPS rebate funds we dedicate towards promoting the program. As you can see, it's probably hard to see in this graph, but our calls to the hotline directly relate to our promotional efforts. So when you see spikes in hotline calls, it really relates to outreach events or promotions we've done. We dedicate money for promotions. We've done a lot of work on developing compelling ads for the program. What we've done is focused on the motivators that farmers have discussed in relation to installing ROPS. As I mentioned, a lot of farmers feel like, you know, I know what I'm doing. I think I'm going to be okay. I could probably operate the tractor without a ROPS. But when they have older children working on the tractor, they are obviously very concerned, as we are as well. So this map shows there are little stars that indicate where we currently have ROPS programs and where we're hoping to launch ROPS programs in the next few years. We have a grant from the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health that will allow us to implement programs in high-risk states and then lay the groundwork for a national program. High-risk states are usually the states, or they are the states that are right around the Appalachian area. This is a picture of our website. So as well as calling the hotline, farmers can sign up for the program online. It's a very easy process. Everyone who participates in ROPS programs, we have a list of participants, and every fourth individual gets a very quick phone call, and we ask them, did you feel like the program was worthwhile? Did you encounter any issues? And then we also ask, would you recommend the program to other farmers? 99% of the 1,800 farmers who have participated said they would recommend the program to other farmers. I think the 1% who would not recommend it, it's really the folks or the farmers who have called and we were not able to find a roll bar for their tractor. That happens about 15% of the time, but for the most part, we can retrofit any tractor that somebody calls about. Here's a map, very hard to see, but this is a map of individual events where a program participant retrofitted a tractor and had a tractor overturned. So these were lives that were certainly saved as a direct result of the program. Here's a picture of one tractor went through three floors of a barn, and the ROPS is not designed to save a person in this type of event, but it turned out that the roll bar did actually save this 18-year-old's life. He walked out very scared, but he did walk out alive. There's another guy retrofitted through the program, had a tractor overturn, lived to talk about it. Another ROPS overturn survivor, or a tractor overturn survivor who had retrofitted through the program. And this is Wayne Connard. Again, same story. So one of the things I also wanted to mention, there is some investment required to have this program available. But we did a cost-benefit analysis in New York, and what we found is looking at the investments made in the program, and comparing those to the cost of fatalities that would have occurred if the program had not been available, New York has seen actual savings by year three of the program. As I said before, we've retrofitted around 1,800 tractors. We have a new rebate structure. We actually provide 70% of the entire cost to retrofit your tractor, up to a cap of $500. And I was also going to talk a little bit about the National Tractor Safety Coalition, which is a multi-industry group that is focused on trying to expand these programs nationally. But since we're short on time, I think all I'll say is we have people from the manufacturing industry, engineers, researchers, farm advocacy groups, farm industry groups who are collectively really trying to make these programs available to other states. So I think I will end with that and then ask if anyone has any questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sorensen.
Welcome.
Excellent presentation. Questions from members of the committee? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This isn't my main question, but do they wear seat belts on these tractors?
They do, and in fact, the folks, so another thing that we do is we survey people who have been through the program. We've asked them if they've had a tractor overturn or a close call, and for the people who have responded to the survey, when we have identified close calls, you know, they've talked about having the roll bar and wearing the seat belt. Not everybody does, but one of the things that our engineers have indicated is just having the roll bar alone will greatly increase their chances of survival. Obviously, ideally, it would be good to have both, but the roll bar is actually quite successful in even limiting the extent of the roll.
Thank you.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do we know in Minnesota how many tractors are used that were purchased before 1997? And our new tractors, do they have more safety features?
New tractors do have more safety features. I don't have an exact figure for how many were manufactured prior to 1986. You know, there are many tractors without ROPS. I look at this as a social justice issue. If we have a known safety, if we have known safety equipment that we know works, everybody should be able to have access to it. I think that's why the program began.
Representative Schultz, we had asked that same question to the Department of Agriculture, and using extrapolation, number of tractors sold and available before 1987, I think it was somewhere around 85, 86,000 tractors that they thought may be out there without protection. And this would be your smaller, older tractors. And in my immediate thought was the tractors that a farmer's going to use to mow his road ditch on that slope of a road ditch. So just a ballpark, that's kind of the number that we're assuming is out there that may be eligible.
One of the things I was just going to mention real quickly is when people call the hotline, we ask them why they're retrofitting their tractor, and very often they say it's because it's a tractor they're using for risky tasks.
Representative Nornes?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to add that where I grew up down in the Red River Valley, you couldn't find a hill. I mean, there was no danger of tipping, but when you come to the ditch and the other uses, obviously there's the danger. Yeah. There are other dangers on those old tractors besides bouncing off and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But this is a very practical, I think, safety issue.
Yeah, roadways are also a big risk. I am involved with Farm Bureau in New York, and a Farm Bureau member of ours unfortunately passed away 3 years ago in a tractor overturn fatality. He was hit by a vehicle and the tractor flipped and he died.
Okay. Dr. Sorensen, you talked about the installation. A farmer would have to provide pictures or certification. Mm-hmm. So is there any liability issue if a dealer does this, or should a dealer do this, or do you allow the farmer to install the ROPS themselves?
In New York State, we actually do allow the farmer to install a ROPS themselves. And when we first started this program, a lot of farmers said, it's very hard for me to take the tractor out of commission long enough to get it. You have to ship it to the dealer and then it takes a dealer time to install it, and then they have to get it back, and if you're, you know, trying to do crops, it's just kind of complicated. So what we did was we had engineers from NIOSH go out and look at ROPs that had been installed by farmers. And interestingly, what we found was they did a very good job of installing the ROPs. I think there was some issues with the actual ROPs manufacturers not clearly labeling directions, but we worked with manufacturers and talked about that and asked them to correct that, which they did. But in Wisconsin, they insist that people dealer install install through a dealer, and that's certainly an option through the New York program. We actually encourage people to have a dealer install it, but if they want to, we let them.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Any more questions? I have a couple if nobody else does. What about the availability? At the earlier meeting, you said certain colors of tractors were either cheaper or easier to locate. What do you find with the availability of aftermarket products such as the roll bar?
We can retrofit about 85% of tractors. Some ROPs are more expensive than others. Typically, your original equipment manufacturer ROPs like John Deere or Kubota are very inexpensive to retrofit. The aftermarket ROPs that are usually required for Case, Ford, you know, any other tractor manufacturer can be quite expensive, which is why we changed our rebate algorithm so that there's no, you know, the farmer doesn't have an out-of-pocket cost that's more than $500.
Okay. You mentioned the call-in center, and could Minnesota utilize the same call-in center that you have in New York State?
Yeah, so if Minnesota chose to, you know, go forward with the ROPS program, we could provide the administrative services, hotline, the research resources. This is provided, the funding for our services is covered by a federal grant. So that will be available for the next few years, and we're hoping to reapply as well. So the only cost really would be promotion and the rebates themselves.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, thank you so much, Dr. Sorensen. We really appreciate you coming out here. Enjoy Minnesota today.
I will. I'll go get a snowsuit.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. And we do have membership here to justify a quorum, so we will officially call it to order. And Representative Schultz, had you had a chance to peruse the minutes, and would you approve those from our last meeting?
Yeah, so moved.
Thank you, Representative. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion is carried. Minutes are approved. Thank you very much. First, the actual bill on the agenda is House File 2516, Representative Daniels. I think I saw him here. Yeah, there he is. Welcome, Representative. This is Ag Country, so you're welcome to sit down and to tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Committee, for hearing my bill. I'm very happy to present this bill.
Just a second. We have to have the bill officially introduced. Vice Chair Franzen, would you like to move the bill?
Yeah, I'd like to move House File 2516, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and welcome, Representative Daniels. Carry on with your bill introduction.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I was working on the farm myself, we had neighbors that had, we all had old tractors. We weren't big time into it. And I suppose I was 13, 14, I remember one of our neighbors actually got caught in a rollover accident, and the dad died in the rollover accident, and pretty detrimental to the family. They were, you know, not older, probably in their mid-40s, you know, young children still, and that was a long time ago for me, and I still remember the community just, you know, hurting from that. So when this bill came forth and I was able to present that, I was very happy that I was allowed to do that. So thank you for letting me do that. This is going to just be a pilot program, basically modeled after the New York program, which Dr. Sorensen did such a great job of giving her presentation. It's basically subsidized at least 70% of the farmer's documented cost on the purchase, the shipping, and installation. to be eligible for the rollover protection, the ROPS, on tractors built prior to 1987. The pilot program statute would expire on June 30th of 2019. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture would administer the ROPS program and must minimize the administrative costs cooperating with the multi-state ROPS program coordinated by the New York Center for Agriculture, Medicine, and Health. MDA would be required to solicit non-state funds for the new program. So we're not looking for state monies. We're looking for basically donations through farmers, groups, and different programs that are already out there already. So to me, it's a win-win. We can offer the farmer up to 70% of cost to put a roll bar on. And it just seems like a win-win bill. And with the presentation that was just given, I won't go into all the details and statistics, but it's definitely a worthwhile program. And I opened up for any questions.
Any questions from members? If not, Representative Franzen, would you care to... you have any closing comments, Representative Daniels?
Yes, I just... there again, this hits probably a number of people that know somebody that died in a rollover accident. And after I was given this bill, last Sunday I was at church, and the lady that's on our little prayer team there, she came to me and she had read the bill that we're presenting today, and as a child she had a friend of the family that also lost their dad, and he was like in his mid-30s, and she had impressed upon me the importance of having this bill, because that family that lost their dad at like 33 or 34 years old really had problems dealing with that loss, and anything we can do to protect this type of thing from happening again, I'm all for that.
Again, thank you very much, Representative Daniels, for offering the bill.
Thank you.
The bill's going to be just laid over here in the committee, so no need to move to pass it on to another committee. So the bill is going to be held over here in the Ag Committee. Next up is House File 2502, and that's my share of this bill.
Representative Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I move that House File 2502 be re-referred to the Committee on Ag Finance.
Representative Anderson moves that House File 2502 be re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture Finance. Representative Anderson, would you like to move the A1 amendment at this time?
I would, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson moves the A1 amendment. Discussion on the amendment.
Oh, for me?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I was going to Ag Finance. I know the chair there, and I didn't think he'd give me $1 million, so I'm going to lower my expectations. But, no, I think $1 million was put in the bill originally, and we don't need that much money to get this program going, so I'm going to lower my expectations down and have a better chance of receiving the $250,000 to get the program going. And hopefully we get some donated money as well, too. So that's the reason for lowering the amount down to a very modest figure of $250,000.
Perhaps the rest of your funding is going to my hemp pilot project.
Don't hold your breath.
Are there any questions or further discussion on the author's A1 amendment? All right. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Anderson, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you've heard the basics of the program. We heard that at an earlier meeting, and New York State has it. Several states in the East have it, and Wisconsin also has it. And New York State has state funding for the program. Wisconsin's is all private funding. So the idea here is to combine both and have some state money, hopefully, and also some private money. And we've talked to several of the major ag companies headquartered here in Minnesota, CHS, Foundation, General Mills, ADM, Cargill, Farmers Union Insurance was receptive, ag country, and have commitments from some of those to provide funds for the program. And interest from all of them. So very pleased with the support shown, at least the vocal support for the program. So we hope to get that moving and add that to the state money as well. After I heard the program, I thought it was something we should do in this state. Mainly older, smaller tractors, the putt-putt tractor on the farm, the chore tractor might have a loader on it. And when you get that loader up high in the air, you become more apt to tip the vehicle. So we feel that the need would be there. I do want to emphasize that this is a totally voluntary program. I have had a couple of calls from gentlemen that have a tractor collection and take their tractors to the county fair every year. And they don't want roll bars on their tractors, and that's perfectly fine. You don't have to do this. It's just, for a tractor that's actually used on the farm and that would become safer by installing that bar, and I would suggest the seat belt as well. I have kind of a special guest this morning. When the bill came out, I had an email from a gentleman just to the south of us at Randolph, Mr. Ed Terry, and Ed is back behind me here this morning. And he is a FFA teacher, ag instructor, and also a farmer. So we hit it off very well. And he has a couple of his FFA folks with us today, two sitting back over there, and then one behind us, Tiana Larson, who's going to talk about how the program may benefit their FFA chapter. And they want to be the first in the state to get the roll bar installed with this new program. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to call up Tiana Larson from the Randolph, Minnesota FFA chapter.
Ms. Larson?
And as she's doing that, would one of you want to pass the pictures around to the committee members of some of the things that your FFA chapter has done? Oh, Tiana has. Okay.
Ms. Larson, if you want to state your name for the record, and then go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Tiana Larson from the Randolph FFA chapter. So some of the pictures that we're passing around right now, there's a picture of our Randolph chapter float that we will do in about 3 parades around Minnesota. And then there's a second picture of our soybeans that we have a plot that we farm. A third picture of 3 of our members that have competed in the FFA tractor driving contests. And then another picture of our annual tractor parade. We have a annual tractor parade every year, which this year will be our 14th annual, and we have about 100 tractors from the community that come down and drive, and we have everybody in the community comes to watch. So to talk about it, safety and tractor safety is a high priority in the Randolph FFA chapter. 4 of the past 5 years, a Randolph FFA member has won the State Safe Tractor Operators Contest. And when the team competition for tractor driving was started about 3 years ago, Randolph has won every single year. Our chapter owns several tractors, one of them, which is a 1965 Farmall 706 without rollover protection. We use the tractor to run our chapter farm, and without a rollover protection, it's obviously not as safe as we would like it to be. Many different members drive this tractor when we farm our plot and having many of those members driving, safety is a concern. But at this time, our chapter does not really have the money to buy a rollover protection, which would cost roughly $800 or more. Between 1967 and 1985, U.S. farm tractor manufacturers offered rollover protection as an option, and now it is obviously required on all tractors over 20 horsepower. As of right now, in the U.S., half of the tractors, so roughly about 2.4 million, are without rollover protection, and which is shocking when you think about how deadly the rollover are. Rollover protection limits the degree of rollover by 99% with a seatbelt, therefore reducing death and damages. By passing the bill, it will help eliminate the amount of farmers that try to build their own because they obviously are not certified to build their own rollover protection. To talk about how it would affect not only the chapter but myself, my grandpa has a 1967 John Deere 3020. We use it on our farm for grinding feed for our livestock and raking hay. Over the years, Grandpa has improved the tractor with side steps and a wide front, but he's never really considered rollover protection. Through my FFA farm safety training, I have learned how important rollover protection can be, not only for the safety for myself, but for my family and for everything that is around us. So as we continue to use the tractor in our future, it would be great to get a rollover protection on it.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Larson. Does anybody here on the committee have any questions for Ms. Larson? Representative Lewick.
Madam Chair, not a question, but just a comment. I appreciate your grandpa's choice in tractors. I happen to still own one of them myself. He's got good taste.
Thank you.
Chair Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. And Ms. Larson, thank you for your testimony. It's always great to see the FFAers here testify in front of the committee. And Chair Anderson, I think if we bring FFA members or 11-year-olds with bunnies, we always get our bills passed, right? So thank you so much. You did a wonderful job testifying.
Thank you.
Yes, indeed. Anyone else here on the committee have any questions, comments? Is anybody in the audience? Oh, Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony. I'm impressed with your commitment to farm safety. Are you aware of other FFA chapters that are giving attention to farm safety?
I have several friends that are in the Medford FFA and FFAs up in the northern part of Minnesota, and not as many FFA chapters do as much as we do with tractors. I don't really know of any other FFA chapters that farm a plot like we do, so we have our members go out, actually drive the tractors and farm our plot. So I do not personally know as much, but I know on their farms, if they have any, they practice farm safety.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if this is the question for you. Thank you for your testimony, though. I appreciate hearing from you. But I'm wondering, actually, for the author, maybe how will we guarantee that their chapter will be the first one to be able to do this? Is there a certain criteria or definition to kind of prioritize who might be able to access the funds so that if you can't answer, you're not going to be able to answer that, but so if you want to have
Representative Anderson come forward to take that.
If this bill passes, I will make sure that they get the first roll of a protection bar.
All right. Would you please state your name for the record, sir? I'm so sorry I don't have it up here.
I'm Edward Terry. I'm the agriculture instructor and FFA advisor at Randall.
Oh.
And I'd just like to address the previous question about the commitment of other chapters. Tractor safety is a priority with the state FFA organization. We do have a safe tractor operators contest. And, you know, most instructors teach this. We also have the ability to teach a class and give a certificate to 14 and 15-year-olds to operate tractors greater than 20 horse who do not have their driver's license. So tractor safety is a major push, no question about it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Jerry. It seems like you've done your due diligence in instilling some excitement with tractor safety with your FFA chapter, and that's to me. So, is there anyone that has any questions? No, Representative Chair Anderson, do you have anyone else that would like to testify?
I thought there were, but anybody in the audience who'd care to testify? No.
No? Okay.
I think somebody's coming down, Madam Chair.
Good morning, Madam Chair,
yes,
members
morning.
Of the committee. My name is Carol Fury. I am with Equipalife. We are a statewide nonprofit organization that operates a project called AgriBility. And this rollover protection system is near and dear to our hearts, in that we work with individuals who have experienced a disability or have a medical condition that may interfere with their ability to continue the operation of their business, the family farm. I'm going to give you a couple of examples of times when we know of tractors that if they would have had the roll bar protection system installed, they would not have ended up, number one, a gentleman who lives up by Pequot Lakes fell out of his tractor during the nighttime because he didn't have a seatbelt or a rollover protection system, and he was on a hill and lay in the field the entire night because of his disability, which happens to be cerebral palsy. It was cold. He survived. Couldn't get to his cell phone. He was in the cab. Not only did that happen to him once, but it happened to him twice before someone finally referred him to our program to get assistance and make the corrections to his tractor to make it safe, which we did much more than just a rollover protection system, but that's for another day. What happens when a tractor's pulling a wagon and the hitch comes loose and you have no rollover protection system? Members, anyone have an idea? Those of you who farm? I grew up on a farm. I was the combine queen. I repaired all the combines. Put Carol in the back of the combine and give her the tools. But back to the subject. What happens, I wish I had a little tractor and a little wagon, is that if the tractor should stop and the hitch come break or come apart, that tractor or that wagon can come right up over the top of the back of the tractor and nail the person in the back of the head if they do not have the rollover protection system. And that happens pretty regularly on older hitches. There are many new devices out there that don't cost a lot that can be installed. A couple of our concerns with the bill that I'd like to share with you today is that we are looking at, the way the bill is written, having the state pay a portion of the cost and then seek private dollars to pay the remaining amount. It might be a thought to have the state, since we're looking at a smaller amount than originally was proposed, pay for the $700 or whatever the cap is going to be, and then pay for that fully, and then look for the private sector to implement the program, and have private sector dollars actually pay to make sure that these rollover protection systems are correctly installed on the tractors. Sort of a certification process, not making it more complicated, but making sure that it's done properly. Because we all know, and I will be the first to say so, it's easy to just go in the shop and fix something. But are you fixing it right? And will it stay in place? And will it break? Because something, some structural part that you're attaching the system to is not strong and perhaps needs replacement. With that, that's really basically the recommendation that we have today to bring forward, is that it might be a good consideration to have this committee take a look at that. The other part of it is that it's competing with the community for precious dollars to provide support to farmers, and particularly in projects like AgriBility, which is the only program in Minnesota that actually goes out onto the farm and helps people from the fence line to the kitchen. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for taking the time to hear my testimony.
Thank you for your thought-provoking testimony, Ms. Friere. Representative Anderson, do you have any closing comments?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I think we in the agriculture community...
Representative Anderson, can I interrupt you for a moment? I believe that Representative Rarick had a question. Or was that Representative Poppy? Sorry. It's hard to figure out who's pointing to who up here.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for interrupting you, but I do have a couple of questions about the bill, so I just wanted to get back to that. So one question I have, you mentioned that, you know, we'd encourage seatbelt use, and that's not required. My understanding is the rollover protection by itself is not going to be effective unless you actually do have the seatbelt requirement to use. So that's my first question, I guess. How would that... if you have one without the other, that might not be as effective as you'd like. So,
Ms. Fury?
Your response to that. For you, Chair Anderson.
Oh.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Representative Poppy, no, I agree with you. And I had assumed that the seat belt was part of the installation of a roll bar. And now the lady from New York, Dr. Sorensen, said that it evidently was not mandated out there. But we'd have to look at that to see if we should do that here. But I agree that it should be part of the installation. And, you know, I drive tractors, and sometimes you might not want to put a seatbelt on, but I think it should be there, that the seatbelt would be part of the installation when that roll bar is put on. Would be my preference.
Ms. Sorensen, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I think I might be helpful in answering that question. So every ROPS system is provided with a seatbelt. We encourage people to wear it. But my question would be, how would you actually track usage? You can't have somebody on the farm all the time making sure people are using seatbelts. You know, as I said, it's part of the ROPS system. We encourage people to use them. But unless you have, you know, a traffic cop on every farm making sure they're using them, there's no way to know. And so, you know, we feel like it's there. People need to decide to you know, act safely. The other thing I wanted to just clarify is the roll bar alone is actually very effective. Because if you look at the energy, what happens in a tractor overturn is the tractor gets more energy by not having the system on the back. So very often what can happen is a tractor starts to roll and the roll bar is there. It limits the extent of the roll. So I think there are very varying estimates that have gone around, 70% effective with just the roll bar, 92%. I mean, it's highly theoretical, but every engineer I have talked to has said it's better to have a roll bar on there than nothing at all. And certainly better to have a seat belt because it's 99% effective, but just the roll bar alone provides a lot of protection.
Thank you, Dr. Sorensen. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, and a couple of raised maybe a couple of more questions just regarding the benefit and maybe insurance. I'm just wondering, will insurance rates lower for farmers who do this or don't do this? Is there another benefit for doing this?
Dr. Sorensen.
Yeah, we have actually talked with insurance companies quite a bit on that question. What we have been told is that it's very competitive and it's really not possible for them to provide reductions in premiums for someone to do this. But it's possible that with some persuasion, additional persuasion, they could be talked into it. We just have not managed that ourselves.
Representative Poppy. Thank you, Madam Chair. And getting back to the not having tractor cops on every farm, I guess I'll be curious to hear the presentation by Representative Johnson and his bill, because I do think having the farm safety awareness is probably, and I appreciate the FFA students talking about just actually what it would take to be the most safe when you're operating a tractor might be beneficial, because if you think that you have safety because you have a roll bar but you aren't using, I still believe that the seatbelt is an integral part of that safety measure. That's the other thing. I guess I know that you're not going to be able to determine whether or not somebody uses it or not,
yeah,
but encouraging their use probably is something that perhaps the FFA chapters can,
yeah,
be going around to do. And then my other question for Representative Anderson is just regarding lines 1.19 and 1.20 is that the commissioner must be doing this in cooperation with the New York Center, and I understand where that's coming from, but I'm just wondering if that tying us to that New York Center may be something that in the future we might want to be considering, because if something happens there and we don't necessarily want that, how much are we going to be able to adjust what we want to do in Minnesota if we're connected to another state's policies or activities with regards to that?
Dr. Sorensen?
I'll comment on that, Madam
Chair. Mr.
Chair. I think it's a positive to be able to utilize the experience of somebody who's gone through the program, and it would help us to not make some of the hiccups or early mistakes that could happen in a program such as this. So I think the expertise is invaluable. But also the call center would save us a lot of administrative cost to be able to use their system. And it seems to have some federal backing as well, not just from New York State. So I'm fairly comfortable with tapping into that system, and I don't see that as a negative. And if down the road something happens, we would have to address that and address additional funding to our own administrative call-in center if that's what we so choose. But for now, I think this is a very cost-effective way to get going on this program.
All right. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson, do you know of anyone else that would like to testify?
No, I don't, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Anderson, do you have any closing comments? And if you could, like...
Oh. I'm getting the hook here. Madam Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 2502, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture Finance.
All right, Representative Anderson removes his motion that House File 2502, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Agriculture Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. And then, Representative Anderson, actually, would you like to stay up there and move your next bill?
Well, I think I talked to Representative Johnson. If he can do his bill within like a 10-minute time frame, we could then get on to the last bill on the agenda. I think he has agreed that he can, so Why don't you stay there, Madam Chair, and I'll just be a spectator up here.
Oh, how exciting.
You should feel free to join me with Representative Anderson. I'd like to have you on the team. I move that House File 2840 be re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture and Finance.
Representative Johnson moves that House File 2840 be re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture and Finance. Representative Johnson, would you like to move your A1 amendments?
I'm unaware of the A1 amendments.
No? Oh, never mind. There's no A1. Sorry about that. That is that. To your bill, Representative Johnson.
This bill emerges out of a series of articles that I bet almost everybody in this room read in the Minneapolis Star Tribune about farm safety that really illuminated a problem that we have in Minnesota with respect to farm safety. After I read those articles, I reflected on the work we did in the last session with turkey farmers, and one of my reflections on when we were working on the challenge related to the disease related to turkey farmers was how strong our Department of Agriculture is, and how, you know, there's just really the investments in the Department of Agriculture, the Board of Animal Health, those paid off last year. And then I thought, well, this is kind of a hole in the works, or a chink in the armor. And so I thought, well, let's try to address it. The bill essentially gives some flexibility to the commissioner to establish a farm safety program. And if you recall, in the Star Tribune, they identified that deaths on the farm, there was a 30% increase in a 10-year time period of 2003 to 2013. It was interesting. I'm not so sure you can build the correlation, but it is interesting that Wisconsin has had a farm safety program over the last 10 years, and they've seen a 16% drop. Now, again, I'm a social science guy. I'm not so sure you can make that correlation, but it may be informative. We know that the University of Minnesota Extension Service did a lot of work with farm safety back in the day, and in 2001, 12,000 kids in Minnesota attended farm safety camps. That's a pretty staggering number, 12,000 kids. But then in 2003, they experienced the massive budget cuts that really affected extension across the state, and with that went the farm safety program. The article in the Star Tribune identified Washington State as a state that's fairly aggressive with respect to farm safety. It's interesting that they've had 63 deaths over the last 10-year period compared again to the 210 in Minnesota. The article identified some of the things that the state of Washington is doing are safety audits, consulting services with farms. In last year in Washington State, they conducted 294 of these, provided consulting services to 294 farm operations. Since 2010, the state of Minnesota has provided 10. And the point being, we're lagging. And I thought that the best way to address this was to offer to the, you know, to say kind of jumpstart or kind of maybe buy the attention of the Department of Agriculture in Minnesota to address this issue. And personally, the bill, as you see written, is that it focuses on information, helping farmers and their families and their farm workers understand the safety issues that face the farm. I also think, as I've reflected on it, is that the ability to access and coordinate resources, and that's why I was so interested in what you folks are doing in Randolph with the FFA. And I'm also reminded of the work that South Central College at the Center for Excellence on Agriculture does with respect to farm safety. I spoke with Brad Schlesser, the director of that program, and said he really thinks that they could provide some assistance with this as well. So it'd be a matter of coordinating those activities and hopefully, you know, taking a step. And maybe it would mean that next year we would come in with a more thoughtful program, more detailed program. But again, I think it's time to jumpstart it. this isn't the finance committee. I'll be honest, $100,000 was, I chose that number, but I'm certainly willing to work with the department and with the finance committee, Ag Finance Committee, to see what an appropriate number would be. But I think now is the time for the legislature to speak up and stand up and say we need to work on this issue in a broader context, and that's the purpose of the bill. You were also received a letter, a copy of an editorial that was published in the Mankato Free Press, and so the point being that I think that others in Minnesota are recognizing this need, and so again, that's the point I have to make today.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I believe that you have a testifier. Ms. Carol Fury wants to testify on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I was instructed to be concise. That means quick.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm just here to support the concept of creating a safety program for the state of Minnesota. As I mentioned earlier, we work with farmers who are injured. We actually do assessments on the farm, safety assessments, and we're labeled or discussed. Our program was discussed in about awareness building in that four-part series about the work that we do. Couple of the points that we'd like to bring to the table today, surround the full funding for the $100,000 and taking a look at beginning this project with the notion that it become a full safety bill, and that the Department of Agriculture is responsible under this bill for the design of the safety awareness program. And developing partnerships which engage others to create what is referred to as a long-term safety program. One of the components being the ROPS project, as we've already discussed today, which leads to reduced injuries on the farm. There are a number of other issues that could and should be involved in this particular bill, such as unsafe grain bills, older farms, the problems with augers, rotting fence posts, unlocked chemicals, and the list continues. Bringing solutions to the table as part of the overall safety bill on the farm initiative, using modernization, technology for aging farmers, such as remote cameras, automated technologies to open gates, reducing unforeseen accidents with safety devices on all moving vehicles, stopping on a dime from the fence line to the kitchen. We recommend full funding. Start with the ROPS and the awareness program that is being built around that, building sustainability beyond government funding, and report to the legislature each year during the project implementation, and then at five-year intervals once the project is fully put together. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Fury. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify? Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you, Representative Johnson, as well, and everybody that's bringing attention to this. And I'm wondering how we can work together and utilize some of the existing programs as well. I Googled the U of M Ag Extension, and they have, if you go on the tab and hit small farms, they have list safety behind that, safety for barn fires, animal washing or hand washing stations, groundwater testing equipment, regulatory and food safety. They walk you through buying a used tractor. You can go with food safety, and they have a number of programs there as well. Food safety program, a food safety team, how to prepare and preserve food, and a whole certificate program, sanitation, food service, food processing. You go to the University of Minnesota's the Agriculture Department here in Minnesota, and you type in simply safety, and there's 10 pages listed on things that we're doing, providing safe locally grown produce, food and feed safety division, ag chemicals and fertilizers, handling pesticides, potential hazardous foods. MDA encourages safety and awareness this upcoming harvest season that was put out on September 15th. And so I guess what I'm saying is there's a number of things that are taking place currently, and can we look at that and better target the existing resources and the folks that we have addressing this currently, and like I said, utilize what we have in place, but better target it versus starting another division. Is that something that we could look into further, I guess?
Ms. Fury, or Representative Johnson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hamilton. I think the point, in a way, you're kind of making my point, in that there are things going on out there, and it's a matter of coordinating it and getting the full force of that. A number of those things that you, the items you identified, were really more related to food safety, and there wasn't a lot on worker safety. And I think we also have to be cognizant, I don't have the numbers on this, but I'm going to speculate, that farming as it's changed in the last 15 years since we had a safety program, and I'm thinking certainly in my lifetime, we see more employees on the farm. Whereas, you know, in my uncle's farm, he was pretty my uncle and farming with his brother and that sort of thing, and maybe a hired man or two, but the model has changed. There's more people that are actually working on the farm as hired labor, and I think we need to be more cognizant to the workplace safety. The purpose of this bill is to zero in on that. Now, 210 deaths in 10 years is a serious deal, and I think we're remiss if we don't really draw that attention. And so that's, in many ways, what I'm trying to do here. I don't see a new division of that. And one of the reasons with this bill, I purposefully wrote it, as I mentioned, giving the commissioner some leeway on how to kind of do that coordination. I think there's times where it's valuable for the legislature to give directives. I think in this case, where we're trying to jumpstart, get going on something, I think the managerial decisions have offered to the commissioner in this case would offer him a chance as he develops over this year to create something. And again, I would see him coming back next January with a larger idea of it. But I think we're coming into the farming season. I think, you know, let's not waste time. Let's take the initiative.
Right. Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you.
And then if we could wrap this one up, yep, so we can move on.
I understand. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Johnson, I wonder if it'd also be beneficial if a few of us, or all of us, would sit down with the Department of Agriculture and the University of Minnesota as well, and just make sure, because I think there's a lot of very good people working on safety. Again, it's, are we working, you know, are we directing it into the appropriate place, if that makes sense.
Representative Johnson.
And thank you, Madam Chair. That's exactly what I actually would like to do. In many, you know, we're always in a hurry. I actually thought this forum, or actually in a committee forum, I'd be comfortable in chatting that out in that fashion, but I'm more than glad to do that, and we'll see what we can put together. I think that's really what I'm trying to do. Let's start to figure it out, give the department some leeway to work and get rolling on it. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Fury. Is there anybody else that would like to come up and testify either for or against House File 2840? All right, seeing none, Representative Johnson, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I renew my motion that House File 2840 be referred to the Committee on Agriculture Finance.
Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 2840 be referred to the Committee on Agriculture Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. And the motion prevails. Next bill on the agenda is House File 3125. Representative Anderson, you're back up. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, ma'am, I would.
Representative Anderson moves that House File 3125 be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform. Representative Anderson, would you like to move your A1 amendment at this time?
Yes, ma'am, it's technical. I think Colby could explain it for us.
Absolutely. Colby?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the A1 has a series of what I consider to be technical amendments for the committee's mm-hmm. consideration. On the first one, on line 1.2, corrects the reference to bio-based content within the new definition of bio-based content. I spoke with the attorney who drafted this bill, and he agreed that this was an appropriate change to clarify and eliminate some ambiguity in the definition. The next change on line 1.3 of A1 is on page 3 of the bill. This is actually just correcting a typo so that the sentence reads accurately. And lines 4 and 5 of the A1 would insert the word previous before calendar year. This is within the subdivision that creates exemptions from the new lubricating oil requirement. Renewable lubricating oil requirements. So this just creates a frame of reference. So the period that the agency who was implementing the statute would look to determine if a manufacturer or a product is exempt would be the sales during the previous year rather than an unspecified calendar year.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Is there any other further discussion on the A1 amendment? All right. Representative Anderson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, we have to vote on your amendment?
Yes.
Yes, sorry about that. Okay, so all those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Anderson, now to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd like to introduce House File 3125, today's hearing, and hopefully have it move on to the Commerce Committee. The bill has certainly attracted a lot of attention, as evidenced by all these new faces in the Ag Committee today. And to be honest, some of that attention has not been all that positive. The bill makes a major change in how Minnesota aligns its market for the sale of motor oils for light-duty cars and pickups. I understand that concern and was skeptical about it myself when we first started to work on the bill. But as we discussed the pros and cons of moving ahead, and it does have some positive and negative impacts, I kept coming back to the premise that this is a very, very good base oil product. And I think it's good that we at least take a look at the idea and see if we can somehow incorporate this relatively new technology into a product that we all use every day in our cars and trucks. You talk about tests have shown so far better engine protection with a biosynthetic oil-based product. I could give you a number like a 1.06 micron cam wear rating when a score of 90 is allowed, or a piston deposit rating of 8.5 where 4 is considered to be a minimum acceptable rating. We're looking at higher mileage numbers coming for the U.S. car and truck fleet. For model year 2014, the average EPA CAFE standard mileage for new cars was 24 miles a gallon. By the year 2025, that number is going to be increased to 40 miles a gallon. And tests with a bio-based motor oil have shown an increase of around 3% in fuel economy in certain tests done with the product such as this. So it could help in that area as well. And the adoption of bio-based lubricants, and I took this from, I was looking last night in my research and picked up my phone and went to a site called the Narayan News Wires and a market-to-market commentary type thing. Didn't pick it up preferencing one or the other. But it said this, the adoption of bio-based lubricants to reduce harmful environmental effects is a current trend in the lubricants market and is boosting the overall growth in that market. The need to enhance fuel efficiency of vehicles has led to the replacement of traditional materials with synthetic lubricants. This trend also has a high influence on the overall market. The article finishes by saying the top companies in the lubricants field include Shell, Lukoil, Exxon, Mobil, BP, Total, and others. So it's a big market, and we're looking at making a significant change. And I realize there's some angst to it, and we just would like to get it out there and get it looked at. And with me today is Mr. Greg Blake, and I'd like to introduce him, Madam Chair, to talk further about the bill.
Yes, Mr. Blake. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chairman Anderson and committee members for allowing me to be here and for discussing this. I am with Biosynthetic Technologies, and I need to apologize very quickly. I had oral surgery this week, and I'm wearing a new device, so if I sound like I've been drinking this morning or something. It's just it's just that.
Water. Drink water.
I've been drinking lots of water. Thank you. Biosynthetic Technologies is a USDA technology transfer partner, and the USDA for decades has sought a way to increase the performance of vegetable oils in higher technical requirement lubricant applications. Vegetable oils have worked great in many lubricating applications because of some of the inherent deficiencies of the vegetable oil. They have not worked in motor oil and some other such applications. So with the development of Hyolake soybean oils, that has enabled further technology, and then their technology breakthroughs have allowed a product that performs on par with petroleum and outperforms in many situations to serve the 12 billion gallon lubricant market and also serve the USDA's primary function of benefiting the U.S. farmers. It is our company's job then to commercialize that technology. Our model is to make and sell base oil, which is a primary ingredient in any lubricant, and we sell that to the existing motor oil and lubricant manufacturers. We have a board member of our company who used to run Exxon's lubricant division. He tells us and warned us multiple times that the oil majors who have current products will be interested in testing these new technologies. They will want to know how they work, and then they will put them on the shelf until somebody somewhere tells them that they need to use these products because they don't want to displace the petroleum that they currently produce and make. So we're excited about this bill, that it would do that, that it would create incentives for innovation, create a level playing field, and to nudge some of these companies toward more environmentally acceptable lubricants. Our company individually and our policy efforts have focused particularly on motor oil because, for two reasons, it has a lot of environmental issues associated with it. In fact, over 40% of the water pollution in the United States comes directly from used motor oil, and it also has high performance demands. And the idea from our perspective being that if we can show that these new bio-based products work in motor oil, they're going to work in a lot of applications as well. So a motor oil is essentially a recipe, a formulation of base oil plus chemical additives that help meet the requirements of the intended application. Our base oil, that we've certified a motor oil formulation, and I was handed an opposition letter today that describes the process that certification takes, and I think it very accurately and fairly describes that. It says original equipment manufacturers, the automakers, and lubricating oil and additive oil manufacturers spend years evaluating lubricant formulations against their own rigorous performance specifications and standards developed by certification bodies such as the American Petroleum Institute to determine if they can be safely used in motor vehicles and satisfy manufacturers' warranties. And it goes on to say that the API, the American Petroleum Institute, engine oil standards are performance-based. So to demonstrate the performance of our base oil, we went through those rigorous testing standards, certified formulations, a 5W20 and a 5W30 motor oil formulation that passes every current standard established by the petroleum industry and the automakers' warranties. And we're pleased with this bill that it specifically addresses those concerns with language that requires any oil under this standard to meet current automotive industry standards and protect the consumer warranties. As far as the environmental performance, bio-based oils, to kind of set the table a little bit with what happens with used motor oil, roughly 35 to 40% of that oil is lost in use, meaning it leaks out onto the roadways or is burned in the combustion chamber. Another 15 to 20% is illegally disposed of. People improperly dispose of that, and the balance is recycled. So one of the very first things we did as a company, we wanted to make sure that our product would fit in the current recycling streams, and that there wouldn't be any disadvantage with that because used motor oil has to be recycled where it can. So we submitted our product, both our base oil and used formulated motor oil, to some of the largest re-refiners in the country. They determine, they run what's called a Lux test to utilize, that's utilized to replicate what's happening in their refineries. We pass those tests, and Safety Clean, which is the largest re-refiner in the country, along with the United Soybean Board and a company, a petroleum laboratory called Intertech, also did a study specifically with oleic soybean oil in the re-refining process and concluded that there was no problem with that. So we've checked that box. It is recyclable and re-refinable. And re-refining is a subset of recycling. Most of the oil that gets recycled is burned as a fuel, up to 85-90% of that, depending on the year. So being a renewable product, you reduce the GHGs from what is burned. It is highly biodegradable, both before, in the base oil form, formulated as a motor oil, and when it is used, you know, for thousands of miles, it's still highly recyclable, much higher than the petroleum-based oil. It has, it's virtually non-toxic in the aquatic environment. It does not bioaccumulate in the tissue of marine animals, and it is fuel. It has a great fuel economy performance, as Representative Anderson mentioned. And he mentioned some of the reasons for that. And this gets into the performance benefits, but fuel economy is also a huge environmental issue. Because if you're able to displace 3% or more of the fuel that's being burned in vehicles by using a better lubricant, that's a significant petroleum reduction, GHG reduction, and it's a significant savings to the consumer as well. But that fuel economy benefit is possible in part because of the, it's called the, well, the technical performance of the oils, but Chairman Anderson represented the wear issue. 1 micron of wear out of 90 allowed, so there's virtually no wear. A very clean engine. In the brochure you were handed, you can see a picture of an engine that was used. This engine went 200,000 miles with our product and has virtually no varnish, no gunk in there, versus the petroleum engine that went 150,000 miles. And so that's, we think, a very good benefit in that it also offers a fuel economy gain. We are just one of many technologies that are coming along and working in this field, so I can only speak to what we're doing and as far as specific data, but I can tell you about the other companies that are out there. And there are a handful of companies that, in addition to us, have gone and gotten the full API certification for their oils. So they have proved and demonstrated that their oils work to meet the manufacturer's requirements. API also has a base oil classification that they use, and there's a group 1 through 5. Group 1 and 2 are the conventional oils. Group 3, 4, and 5 are what they consider synthetic. And from a flexibility perspective, there's a company called Novi that makes a group 3 bio-based oil. There's a company, Elevance, that makes a group 4 bio-based oil. We make a group 5 bio-based oil. So there are manufacturers that are working and making these oils that can be used and formulated in a variety of ways, a variety of formulations. There's also in Europe where there's been significant progress in these oils. There's a list of, you know, multiple pages of manufacturers who make renewable, biodegradable, non-toxic, non-bioaccumulative base oils used in formulating these lubricants. There's, in fact, here in Minnesota, the Minnesota soybean processors in Brewster just invested in a company, a technology that does the same thing with soybean oils, converting them into these base oils. And there's also the USDA maintains the Federal Purchasing Program, the BioPreferred Program. They have a list that includes engine oils that lists manufacturers who are making bio-based oils. One name you'd recognize certainly on that list is Valvoline, who has a product with greater than 50% bio-based content. These group 3 through 5 oils are synthetic. They are higher performing. They have the fuel economy gains, the extended drain intervals. Synthetic oils are typically more expensive than the lower performing conventional oils that you're used to, but they will last 2 to 3 times as long. You've got fewer oil changes, you've got better engine protection, and a real big benefit is the fuel economy gain. So when compared apples to apples, I would argue these synthetic oils, petroleum or bio-based synthetic oils, have a lower operating cost than a conventional oil. And it's my belief that as a measure like this takes hold, the law of supply and demand will kick in and balance that price to a market. And then there's a provision in the bill that if the price is an issue, there's an exclusion in there for that, as well as the producers I've mentioned who are producing these oils and working on these oils. They're doing it without really a market having developed. So this bill is aspirational in the sense that it sets out a date into the future and gives these companies who are working on this reasons to really ramp up their innovation to try and produce more and better alternatives. And there is also an off-ramp in the bill as well relating to that. The bill also is very sensitive to the needs of small producers. There's an exclusion for them. There's an exclusion for large companies who make specialty products, low-volume products. And there is an exemption in there for the retailers who might have the traditional petroleum products in stock well past when the bill is to be implemented so that they can sell down their current inventory. So I believe this bill offers a benefit to the consumer, a benefit to the environment, and a benefit to the soybean growers. I thank you for your time and ask for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Blake. I just got a quick question. For newer cars, if someone were to switch to this brand of oil, would it void any warranties?
Well, Madam Chair, that's a great question. And by this brand of oil, we anticipate there will be lots of brands of oil. The bill specifies that it needs to meet the automaker standards, and so it would not void, as long as it meets the automaker standards, it's not going to void their warranties when used according to the owner's manual, the operating instructions, because they will specify what viscosity grade you need to use, the certification required by them and the industry certifications, as well as the mileage intervals that you should change your oil. But when compared to what's out there, there would be no difference in that regard.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Blake answered my questions or comments in his testimony. I do represent the area where the Brewster plant is located, and so he did mention that as well. Thank you.
All right, does anybody else have any questions for Mr. Blake? Seeing none, next up we have Mr. Riley.
Madam Chair, I'm not Mr. Riley. My name is Sandy Naren, and I am here on behalf of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, which is a trade association of the 12 largest car manufacturers in the world. And I'm just going to briefly give you an intro, and then Mr. Riley will take over. I wanted to make sure that the committee was made aware of a letter that I think is in your packet. The letter is from a number of trade associations, including the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, the Petroleum Marketers Association, the Retailers Association, Service Station and Convenience Store Association, Grocers, Automobile Dealers Association, and the American Petroleum Institute, who I think also submitted a separate letter raising concerns about this bill. And first of all, I would like to thank Representative Anderson for his kindness and spending time talking with some of us about this, and also thank the advocates for doing the same thing. They were kind enough to meet with us yesterday and talk through some of these issues. It sounds to many of us like there is a good product that might be out there. Unfortunately, it's not commercially available at this point. And more importantly to my client, none of them have tested this. It has not been tested by any of the car manufacturers at this point. So it's a very, very new product and something that may be down the road work out, but right now it has not been tested by anybody. Car manufacturers have fairly rigorous standards before they recommend any oil, and every manufacturer recommends different oils for different vehicles. Some of them recommend petroleum, some of them recommend synthetics. It's not the same for every manufacturer, and it's certainly not the same for every car that every manufacturer recommends. This bill is similar to a bill that was heard in California a few years ago, and some of the other concerns that we think still need to be addressed that were talked about in California, and the bill did not pass there, are the additional costs with supply and demand. There are, certainly will be costs to state government, to local government, and to consumers for a unique product that is not yet being commercially produced. There were also concerns raised in California by the recyclers that even though they may be able to recycle this product, they may not be able to recycle it through the normal stream that they do, and they would be have capital investments to handle it. And with that, I will defer to a fuel person who knows a lot more about this.
Thank you, Ms. Niren. Go ahead, Mr. Riley, with your testimony, if you'd state your name for the record first.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Ted Riley. I'm the General Manager of Lubricant Sales at Cath Fuel Oil Service, just north of us here on Rice Street. I'm here today to express our concerns with the House File 3125 mandating the 25% bio added to current motor oil here in Minnesota. Minnesota would have a unique formulation of its own. This would drive price up to the end consumer and those that market the products. We would see fewer options for the end user as far as brands. Increased price might lead to lost revenue and sales for not only repair shops, but marketers like myself, and might send some of these customers to our neighboring states. Our requirements to ensure these new formulations meet the API and OEM standards for all current vehicles on the roads. The cost associated with said tests, the time frame associated with all these tests that need to be run and performed. Each manufacturer has its own specs and tests for every vehicle. Are the Mobil, Citgos, and Chevrons in the industry going to produce different formulations just for the state of Minnesota to meet new car specs when they already exist here? Cost considerations, synthetic base stocks are the most costly groups of base oils in the market. Bio-based oils are typically 4 to 5 times higher in price. Logistics, ample supply sources with competitive pricing, the availability of qualified bio-based materials and manufacturers in our marketplace would also be a problem. Will our current recyclers be able to pick up and dispose this new bio-based product? Costly training, advertising of new product, new SDS requirements and labeling programs. A bill requiring the state to conduct a life cycle analysis of lubricants before allowing bio-based oils to be sold. That kind of puts the product performance on the state and not the manufacturer. The results that I've seen and met, with our current supply of base oils and finished product that we have now, will currently do just the same as a bio-based product now. Long drain intervals, fuel economy and durability, motor oils of today aren't the old 3,000-mile change intervals of yesteryear. So for these reasons that we respectfully do not support the renewal motor oil mandate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kaff. Or Mr. Riley, sorry.
Wish Mr. Kaff.
I bet. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers, either one, I guess. Do you recall the groups of your association that you're affiliated with? What's your position on the fuels when they're first introduced as far as ethanol and biodiesel, when those products first hit the market, and has that position changed today?
I'm not a fuel expert. I'm just strictly lubricants for our company. But when bio first introduced, I know we had a lot of hiccups when that first came out as far as the formulation and gelling and the glycerin dropping out. so it's, it was a learning experience.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, I could only speak on behalf of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, not the others on this list, but the automobile manufacturers did not oppose biodiesel mandate when it was 2%. They did not oppose it when it was 5%. They did have concerns when it went to 10% that it was a little ahead of the market. There was concern that some of them had not yet warrantied for more than B5. And there was also concern about the 110,000 diesel vehicles that were already on the road in Minnesota that were only recommended by their owner's manuals to use B5. So.
Yeah, Ms. Nairn, if you could just move the microphone.
That answers your question.
If you could just move the microphone a little closer.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Are there any other further questions of the testifiers members? Does anyone else wish to testify either for or against House File 3125 as amended? All right. Representative Anderson, do you have any closing comments?
Madam Chair, I was concerned we were going to run out of time, but this is didn't take as long as I thought. Thank you all for at least listening, those in the audience as well. I know the bill raises a lot of questions, but I think it's good that we at least talk about it. I still think that this is a very good product, and you know, a lot of us have thoughts about mandates, things like that, and I do as well. But there's something about making the marketplace accessible, and you know, what comes first, the market or the product? You know, it's a tough question to answer. If you ramp up production to bring the cost down and the market's not there, then that doesn't work either. So how do you do this in a way that makes sense and doesn't disrupt the folks we have doing the job now in Minnesota? We don't want to do that at all. But again, because the product, at least in my opinion, is an excellent product, I think we should look at it and at least talk about it and see what we can do to possibly make this work. That would be my closing comment, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Anderson renews his motion that House File 3125, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those in opposed say nay. All right. The motion prevails, and we are adjourned.